Hi, I'm Brian Pearson. This is the Mystic Cave.
We were born before the wind. Also younger than the sun. And our modern boat was one as we sailed into the Mystic.
The Mystic Cave is a sanctuary for the seeker. Stories, conversations, and reflections about the spiritual journey on the other side of Churchland. I'm reading from my memoir, Lost Rites, Leaving Churchland. In this episode, I arrive in Calgary to begin my new ministry. We were met by challenges that might have made us question the move, but also by the sense of a guiding hand that was not only opening doors, but beckoning. As the new prairie landscape unfolded before our eyes, we were more excited than nervous about the new life awaiting us. This is Chapter 11, Part 1.
Just like way back in the days of old. And together we will flow as we sail into the Mystic. Come on, come on.
No sooner had way opened for our move to Calgary than it closed again, in our faces. Somebody wanted us there, I was sure of it. I felt it with Sandy's happiness to be coming home again. I felt it with my interview at St. Stephen's early in July. But when we returned later that same month to look for a house, we needed something more tangible than feelings. We needed a miracle. Having lived on the poverty line for 2 years on the coast, we'd accumulated debt, not savings. We had nothing for a down payment in the upscale real estate market of Calgary. The diocese agreed to purchase a 15% interest in our house so we'd have something to bring to the table, but we'd be on our own after that to carry the mortgage. Sandy and I stayed with a friend in a small upstairs guest room while the kids stayed with their grandparents across town. For 3 days, Sandy and I went out with a realtor, considering all the options, house after house after house, until our heads hurt. Finally, we found a house we thought would fit a family of five, a bedroom for Heather downstairs, two adjoining bedrooms for the boys upstairs, with both a family room off the kitchen and a playroom in the basement, all the space we would need to come together or to go to our corners as the kids entered their teens. Even a tiny basement study for me. We negotiated our price, made an offer that was conditional on financing, and then turned things over to the bank. But when the bank called us in the next day, it was to dash our hopes. We needed two confirmed full-time salaries to satisfy them that we could carry the mortgage. Sandy was looking at a number of job opportunities. We were confident that one of them would work out. But without a firm job offer on the table, we had only my salary, and that was not enough to qualify us for the mortgage. The sale was lost. We returned to our friend's house that evening, the wind gone from our sails. Over a pot of tea at the kitchen table, we reviewed our options. Let's see. There were, well, none, actually. I had accepted my exciting new job. I had announced my departure from the West Coast mission. Now we were hanging in midair, somewhere between the two. I said I was going to bed. It had been a long time since I'd prayed personally, using words. My prayer life over the years had turned inward. I meditated, sometimes on a prayer stool, sometimes with scripture, sometimes as I walked, sometimes by journaling. It could be characterized more as a kind of mindfulness than prayer in the traditional sense. I just couldn't reconcile myself to the idea that God was some sort of celestial bellboy doing my bidding, that God would put everything on hold like saving the world, to attend to my stated wants and needs, so I'd stopped asking. But as I climbed the stairs to our room, each step groaning beneath my weight, I began composing in my head a desperate prayer to throw out to the universe. I undressed, got into bed, and turned out the light. "I don't know how this works," I whispered into the dark. "But I don't know what we're supposed to do here. So please, send down your heavenly angels or whatever and help us get through this. We've run out of hope." And then I drifted off. I was awakened a short time later. Sandy hadn't come up yet. I felt strange. I was lying flat on my back, pressed deep into the mattress, as if I was made of concrete, heavy and immobilized. Was this some sort of paralysis? Yet it wasn't frightening, and I wasn't alarmed. It felt peaceful, actually. Very peaceful. It occurred to me that I wasn't alone. A presence seemed to be with me in the dark at the foot of the bed. No, two distinct presences, though discernible only by some sixth sense. I could see no one. They were performing a sweeping gesture over my body, one at my feet, the other at my head, a repeated flowing motion as if they were redistributing my body's energy. These days, I would identify their action as what Reiki practitioners do, making me a believer. I became aware of Sandy entering the room. She was standing in the doorway, looking down at me. I still felt paralyzed, and anyway didn't want to break the spell. I don't even know if my eyes were open, or if I was only intuiting her there, as I was the presences. After that, I don't recall another thing. In the morning, I got up and went downstairs to put some coffee on. Sandy had a funny smile on her face when she joined me. "Well, that was weird," she said. "What was weird?" "Last night, when I came up to bed, there was some kind of glow around you, as if maybe there was a nightlight on behind you on the other side of the bed. But there wasn't. It was just you. I thought, great, is he supposed to be Jesus or something?" I was about to tell her of the presences, but our friend entered the kitchen, and then the phone rang. It was Sandy's sister, Heather. We were not close to her sister. In fact, we tended to keep our distance because she could be volatile. Things would get said and feelings would get hurt if you caught her in the wrong mood on the wrong day. But this morning, she sounded conciliatory and genuinely concerned about us. Last night, she and her husband, Glenn, had been discussing how we were going to manage a mortgage, especially since Sandy wasn't working yet. They were wondering how things were going and whether or not we might need them to co-sign a mortgage for us. Suddenly, we were back in business. Way was opening for us after all. We returned to the bank and signed the papers. We then drove back to the coast to begin our preparations for the move. I didn't know quite what to say or to whom to express my gratitude. Does God really work that way, I wondered? I didn't know. But the universe had just grown more mysterious, kinder, and immeasurably larger. After 2 months of separation, when I finally drove into Calgary that last week in October, it was a giddy reunion for us all. Sandy had started getting mushy in the notes she sent me, and the kids were going stir-crazy, living in their grandparents' basement. My daughter Heather had written to me that they now had not two parents, but four. 2 months was a long time for them to be living out of a suitcase, especially as the kids were getting launched in their new schools. Those months had been happy ones for me on the coast, but I knew that was only a brief working sabbatical, like the whole 2 years had been in a way. Now I had to get in the game to start this new life, which we needed to do together as a family. That meant settling into our new home, resolving Sandy's work situation, and wrapping my head around St. Stephen's, my new parish. most churches are a study in sameness. They reflect the demographics of the community from which they draw their membership. So, if you were to drive your BMW up to a little country church, say, wearing a suit and tie or clutching a Gucci handbag, you might feel a little out of place when you walked in. After all, most of the church members would have known each other all their lives. They neither needed nor wanted to draw attention to themselves. Being noticed in a small town doesn't usually go all that well for you. As visiting city folk, you're going to stand out, and they're going to notice you. Same thing in a suburban church overflowing with young families. Try attending some Sunday morning as a single person, or as a childless gay couple, and you too will feel the sideways glances as the congregation parts to move around you, like oil and water, giving you your space. Oh, they're happy to see you. They're happy to see anyone new. They're just not too sure off the bat how well you're going to fit in. This isn't necessarily a failing of the church. One might even say it is its strength, that it is capable of creating a tangible sense of community from among the local population. The stronger the mutual identification, as a particular age group or as a particular socioeconomic station, the stronger the bonds of friendship. A church can accomplish quite a lot if its members, in the first place, like each other. But a city parish is not homogeneous to begin with. It's diverse. Like churches in other environments, it may draw from its local neighborhood, but that neighborhood includes everyone from judges to street people. It also attracts members who drive in from the suburbs, passing several other churches along the way, looking for that very diversity. This describes St. Stephen's Church in Calgary, a lively and diverse midtown congregation, as we labeled ourselves. I recall one Sunday morning gazing out from my prayer desk at the front and seeing, literally, John the judge and Peter the street person sharing the same pew. It delighted my heart. Even though Peter couldn't sit still for more than about 10 seconds at a time and alternated between sitting, lying down, and getting up to wander around, which drove John to distraction, having to make way as Peter left the pew, then making way again when he wanted back in. Almost everything about a city church is different from country and suburban churches. A city church is too big for the minister to know everyone personally, the way you do in a country church, and its membership is too spread out to offer the usual weeknight programs the way you can in the suburbs. People don't want to come back to the church in the evenings, so you have to do what you can while they're there, which is Sunday mornings. Outreach in rural and suburban churches is something that usually happens a great distance away. You're always raising money for foreign missions or work projects halfway around the world. But in a city parish, outreach opportunities come right to your door, sometimes literally, without you having to go looking for them. St. Stephen's had addressed the problem of homelessness several years before I arrived, when a man was found sleeping beneath the church steps one bitterly cold Christmas morning. The parish responded by, as one capital campaign put it, opening its doors to the homeless. Members of St. Stephen's met with civic leaders and with representatives from other city churches to study the problem of homelessness. They familiarized themselves with a shelter program in Nashville, Tennessee. Then they organized something similar for Calgary, calling it In From the Cold. It blossomed into a citywide organization involving dozens of faith communities and literally thousands of volunteers. Two or three times a month, the St. Stephen's crews, greeters, cooks, supervisors, set-up and strike teams, welcomed 15 to 20 people from the streets into the church hall for the night. The workers learned the names of their guests and heard their stories. The inn provided safe and humane shelter until the city's homeless could find affordable housing of their own. It also gave church members a tremendous sense of pride in what they had accomplished and confidence in what they felt capable of accomplishing. Worship patterns in rural and suburban churches usually reflect the particular bias of the congregation. toward either the traditional or toward the contemporary. But the diversity of a city church chafes at such sameness. Judging from what I read in the parish profile, the self-promoting description sent out to prospective applicants, I knew the worship patterns at St. Stephen's would be a challenge. The parish had drawn up a kind of armistice between the traditionalists who loved the Book of Common Prayer and the modernists who wanted to experiment with a worship band and a more interactive Sunday morning experience. The early 8 a.m. service held in the side chapel was strictly these and thous. The middle service at 9:15 was contemporary, with a band, fronted by four singers with handheld microphones and a drum that one of them thumped at odd intervals. The main 11 a.m. service, with organ and full choir, tended toward the traditional, but it kept an eye on the Sunday bulletin for what folks had been doing at the contemporary service, sometimes with envy. All this was workable, though, and nothing I hadn't dealt with before, though three distinct worship services every Sunday morning was going to be a bit of a grind. There would be no Saturday Night Live the evening before, that was for sure. But St. Stephen's, I felt, was going to be a wonderful place for me to do my ministry. The diversity of its members, the complexity of its programs, even the challenge of its aging buildings, I welcomed it all. My first Sunday at St. Stephen's was an onslaught of conflicting impressions. My arrival had been preceded by a prolonged interim period, with a procession of guest priests and visiting clergy filling in while the search committee did its work. People had been waiting a long time, and expectations ran high for the new priest, to preach with intelligence and preside with authority while walking carefully the tightrope of Anglican worship preferences, to baptize babies and bury the old without neglecting the needs of teens and young adults, to support In From the Cold while at the same time leading the congregation into its next phase of outreach ministry, to draw the community deeper in its faith through study groups and courses, but without getting too heady, to care for the sick and visit the shut-ins while still being available every day at the office when people dropped by, and then, if time permitted, to participate in the life of the diocese and study and pray and attend to my own spiritual life as well. Despite its recent worship wars, for my first Sunday, the parish had resolved to join all three services in an amalgam of contemporary and traditional worship to present themselves to me as one big, happy congregation. The church was filled. Several people took the opportunity, almost conspiratorially, to plant the seed with me that this was how we ought to be worshiping all the time, together, as one church family, not as three. I smiled. I was introduced to a woman from Sierra Leone with her two daughters. They had turned out in the colorful traditional dress of their culture, having newly arrived in Canada as refugees. This was their first Sunday in church. The diocesan refugee resettlement coordinator had brought them herself, hoping to make a connection with the new minister. The details were more than I could take in, but the coordinator was hopeful I would be able to welcome them and help them settle in. Then at the crowded luncheon reception after the service, down in the church hall, a bossy blonde named Laura inserted herself beside me at the table. She launched into a long and complicated story about a personal situation that resulted in her being in need of money, quite a lot of money, and she was expecting that the church would help her out. I listened, but I said I would need some time. This was my first day on the job, and I didn't yet know how these things worked. She pressed harder, raising her voice, until one of the church wardens escorted her by the elbow out the door. As fulsome as my introduction was to St. Stephen's that first Sunday morning, it was only one of three inaugural events that weekend. The previous day, I had been introduced to my new diocese as well, as it assembled for an episcopal election. Bishop Curtis had retired, and we were there to elect his successor. I was a priest of the diocese, if only for a matter of days, so I was expected to attend and to vote, even before I had met my new colleagues. I found the church where the meeting was taking place and joined the clergy in the pews assigned to us, alphabetically by row, with P's on either side of me. I didn't get to meet anyone from other parts of the alphabet that day, and I couldn't help noticing the puzzled looks on faces when my name was called out in the roll. I knew none of the local candidates, but I did know one of the others, Barry Hollowell, a priest and former colleague from the Diocese of Niagara. Calgary didn't know him at all, except on paper, where he looked very good indeed, wise man always coming from the East. After several ballots that ping-ponged back and forth between two contenders, a charismatic evangelical who was led by the Spirit to come out of retirement to let his name stand for election, and a safe, broad churchman, though not safe enough apparently, the guy from Ontario with all the letters after his name finally broke the deadlock and won the day. But my introduction to my new spiritual home that weekend was still not complete. On the Sunday evening, St. Martin's, the Church of Sandy's family, was moving, literally. After years of stagnation in a tired working-class neighborhood, they were leaving their building, having sold it to a Korean congregation, to take up temporary residence in the gymnasium of a private school several kilometers away. From there, they planned eventually to build a new church and become a beacon for all the new suburban development soon to explode at the city's western edge. The congregation was separating from their past, like a college student leaving home, and it was wrenching for them. But they had recently hired a new priest who was well able to lead them into their new future, Richard Lesueur. Richard had spent time at St. George's College in Jerusalem, where he had studied and then taught desert spirituality. This period for St. Martin's, he told them, would be like the ancient Hebrews wandering for a time in the wilderness until they were ready to occupy the promised land. There was much to be learned and to be gained by welcoming this new, if uncertain, part of their journey. I went with Sandy and her parents to witness this historic event. The first part of the service was held in the old church. Then, when it was time for the offertory, all the provisions they would need for the journey, the cross, the Bible, the torches, the bread and wine, were picked up and carried in procession out of the church. Everyone followed, many with tears glistening in their eyes. We climbed into our cars and reassembled under the symbolic tent of their new desert home, a rustling fabric evocation of the nomadic life they had taken on. Having moved from one church to another myself in Unionville, I fully recognized the significance of what they were doing. I felt pangs of doubt and uncertainty on their behalf, even though these were not my people. Whatever journey had led them to this place, this was a bold and hopeful move that would open them to the strange new destiny that awaited them beyond any horizon they could see. These were all strange portents as I tried to adjust to my new environs. A wise man arriving from the East, a parish choosing to move rather than to die, and my own church seeking the coming of the Messiah himself, and inevitably, soon to be disappointed. And when that foghorn blows, I want to hear it. I don't want to fear it. I've been reading from Lost Rites, Leaving Churchland. As always, I invite you to share your own thoughts and memories. You can leave a post in the Facebook group, The Mystic Cave, or write to me personally at mysticcaveman53@gmail.com. Operators are standing by. In the next episode, I meet my new clergy colleagues and recognize the signs of a deep divide in the diocese. I clear the decks at St. Stephen's to make way for a new and willing staff team. And I even return to my writing with one book already in the marketplace and another on the way. I had hit the ground running. Thanks for listening. I'm Brian Pearson. This has been The Mystic Cave. It's too late to stop now.